Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Thursday, 5th of November, 2020. We're still dealing with the counting of the final U.S. election results. It's looking like that Biden will certainly have the votes to prevail. The question is whether Trump is going to stand down or we're going to have a continued contested election scenario, and if so, for how long. So as we await for those totals, the interesting thing has been an absolute explosion to the upside in the U.S. equity market. You can see that on slide one, where we looked at a 6.5% gain yesterday in the U.S. S&P 500 index, a little bit less than that on the NASDAQ 100. And, I was trying in an internal meeting to put this into perspective and on why this kind of explosive upside is happening. You can try to build a narrative around the election itself, but it seems to me, Peter, and I don't know to what degree you'd agree with me on this, but you had a when you talked about this and you made a very good call actually, that maybe we should sell volatility ahead of the election, that the market was pricing this as the largest volatility risk event of all time, and that absolute collapse, even though we actually do have a slightly contested election scenario, that collapse in volatility is what is driving some offsetting or lifting of hedges around that. Take it away, Peter. I mean, I've got a slide on slide two showing just the daily candles on VIX and move, but you're also talking about the curve. But I'll let you speak a bit, and I'll talk about bonds as well after you've addressed that question.
Sure, I think actually you're mostly right. That is unwinding of these tail risk hedges that definitely was put in place, and yeah, it is a little bit of a shameless self-promotion, but I do actually think that I think a month ago in October 6, I did the first presentation with clients into the election where I basically said short volatility based on our election analysis on the previous elections, and that was just very rich. And I also did it on Twitter, and a lot of people came back with asking, are you really serious about shorting volatility? And just it gave you an idea of people's mindset and the positioning going into the election. And so I think actually you're right, John, that it is exactly what's happening. It's being and we're seeing this unwound. And as you point out on slide two, it's a pretty sizable move downward in the spot VIX, but also in the move which tracks the volatility in the bond index. And on slide three, I've put in the entire forward curve, and you can really see how it's shifting dramatically downwards from previous levels ahead of the election. And I don't think this move is over yet. I think we could come down significantly from this level, but keep in mind, I don't think we'll go back to the big structure we had prior to US brokerage firms making zero commission on trading options and stocks in general. I think the Robinhood crowd and the technical change that was done to commissions in the US have altered the market, and all the retail investors they are bit weekly and monthly call options, and it just has created a different derivative market. So I don't think we'll get back to the old VIX structure, which was so famous and gave people 10 years of plus 30% annualized return on shorting vol. I don't think we're getting back to that. But before I shut up, John, and let you guys come into the arena, I just want to highlight on slide four what we're actually observing in markets, because it's a very sizable move, and I think I call it the less policy uncertainty trades here, because it seems like there's now a path for Biden to take the White House, but then we'll have a most likely a split Senate. I'll let you talk about that, John. And in that case, there won't be any big healthcare reforms, so drug prices will stay elevated. That's why you saw healthcare stocks being up almost 5% and just exploding in European equity markets yesterday. And it's also the reason why I think you're seeing the blue line on the insert on slide four, which is the NASDAQ 100 futures. So the technology segment of the equity market in Europe is sprinting higher versus the broader equity market. And I think that reflects these less policy uncertainty, because there won't be any tax hikes in on corporate income, and especially the intangible incomes that we have been talking so much about.
Yeah, I'll push back a little bit against the positive spin there in a bit. But Ole, it looks like clearly the anticipation and at least in bond markets, or perhaps the forced hedging in the long end of the US yield curve and that unwind, if that's what it was. There wasn't this huge buildup of anticipation in the gold market. Does that suggest that the market is just so, it's kind of a crowded trade? It's just hard to sort of continue to push it over the edge to get it higher? Or is it just because there's a mindless focus on the dollar? Or what's your read here? I mean, gold is really busily boring me a lot lately.
That's true, John. It's we basically anchored around this 1900 level. I think the initial weakness we saw yesterday has obviously been reclaimed, and that was driven by the outlook for a potential Trump staying in power and thereby reducing reflation trade. But now that the results are getting we're getting close to result, we can see this picture emerging that we got Biden in the White House, we got the Republicans in charge of the Senate. So as Peter mentioned, we're not going to see a hell of a lot in terms of massive steps to try to reignite the economy on that background. So the reflation trade has faded. We see that in the bond market where break-even yields are coming down. So inflation expectations have come down quite a bit since yesterday. Real yield still relatively weak at quite an elevated negative level, so that's providing some support at this stage. But I think the increased political uncertainty that we're going to face over the coming weeks and months, that I think that will add some support to the market. And also with the pandemic, we shouldn't forget, we haven't talked about that for a couple of days because of the election, but the pandemic is still raging, not so much in Asia, which is obviously the growth engine, but in US and Europe, it's still forcing governments and central banks to stay on their toes and provide support. And I think that underlying will provide some provide the support the market needs. I'm just watching a little bit the relationship between gold and silver. I've inserted that on as well on slide 9, where first of all you can see that gold needs to break this sequence of lower highs. So we need to see it back above 1930 really to start talking about a potential change in direction or a resumption of the rally. So that's the level I'm watching there. But if you look at the gold silver ratio, we've been in an uptrend, i.e. a weakening trend for silver relatively to gold since September, and we're pretty close to breaking lower on that front. So if that happens, then that would that does probably first of all signal that gold is starting to move higher, but then silver giving its industrial credentials as well will potentially outperform. So silver is in the spotlight here.
All right. And also, as you mentioned, you kind of took us through some of what I think is hitting the FX market, or could hit the FX market, but as well has me questioning why equities, I mean, of course, beyond a significant adjustment, at least we maybe know the outcome here, et cetera, et cetera. What about stimulus? Why, or, at some point, are we not worried about on the fiscal side not getting the stimulus if the economy is struggling to regain its feet? That just doesn't seem to be in the picture. But I think it's interesting potentially for the dollar if yields stay low. And to me, if we're not getting stimulus and we're concerned about economic growth, then it's really only the multiple argument that is left for why stocks can trade at remarkable multiples. In other words, if U.S. long treasury yields continue to go back to where they were near their lows. So you have on slide 4, I'll talk very briefly on FX in a minute, but Peter, you have on slide 4 this sort of less policy uncertainty trades. I suppose, did you already take us through all that, or were there further sectors you wanted to pull out on the mix of reactions?
I think the main thrust here is the long technology and long healthcare on this less policy uncertainty. But I think to a certain extent, I think it's actually positive for both oil and gas industry and the green energy. I know it sounds a little bit weird, but I think actually in the longer term picture over the coming years, a blue wave would have been catastrophic, I think, for the regulatory framework for oil and gas companies, at least in the US. So I think it's getting cleared now, and that's a positive. And I think for the green energy, it would be and have been a not catastrophic, but if it was just status quo, it could have, changed the mood a little bit. But I think the sentiment seems to be that this is actually okay. And a lot of the green energy stocks were actually high in Europe, and then some of them were a little bit down in the US. But I think overall, that's not really a big thing. So I actually think that the market is takeaway on this less policy uncertainty. So uncertainty is actually a good thing, and we'll go back to the old themes that I think Steen also mentioned yesterday on an internal call with clients. I mean, it's about TINA, right? I mean, there is no alternative to equities. We have very low interest rates. High duration assets or long duration assets will be bid up again, and we'll go back to the same playbook, and then we'll see about that inflation next year.
Right. And then in the FX market, you're seeing the usual suspects. When you have risk on, high liquidity, the relief trade on fear hedges, et cetera, the dollar does poorly. The yen does somewhat poorly. I think the yen is a bit more interesting, but euro dollar, you can see it on slide six. I mean, it's almost exactly mid-range back to where we were. We're waiting for a 119 break or a 116 break, and the whole cloud hanging over Europe on COVID-19, the sluggishness of any stimulus, which I think in Europe's case would be more positive than in the US case, is going to be a slow and ugly and difficult prospect to get to, et cetera, et cetera. But I think dollar yen a bit more interesting if we look at that on slide seven. It's edging a little bit lower, and this 104 area looks very, very significant. And if the idea is that we avoid with this political gridlock in the U.S. for at least the next 2 years until the 2022 midterms, and we presume that Biden does become president and the Senate does not get into into Democratic hands, which appears virtually impossible at this point, that political gridlock, the Republicans blocking virtually everything all of that stimulus or most of that stimulus that would have been forthcoming under a full blue control across the board, this to some degree derails the reflation trade, and that is more supportive of the Japanese yen than would have been otherwise the case. So watching the yen sensitivity around here, the offset to that is that if we continue to see crazy speculative energy in equities and upside there, that this is not necessarily a very yen positive backdrop. But the reflation story, I think, is where it could get some drivers. Now, we've been a little bit neglectful in covering just what is the remaining little margin of uncertainty in the U.S. Election. This is not your main source of that kind of thing, but just my takeaway is here that you can see it on slide five. I've used the New York Times look at the electoral map. The fact that Alaska is on there is totally unserious, but it's more about some other outfits have called Arizona for Biden, even though there is some marginal uncertainty, in which case Biden is at 264 electoral votes and only needs either, if that is the case, if Arizona stays in his hands and there's Republican calls that maybe the vote could tilt there. But if that Biden call is correct there, then he only needs either Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. The vote count in Pennsylvania is not complete. It is clearly going to end up in Biden's hands, but that is where they're focusing the sort of stop the count, vote count effort. You can see the totals of the votes already with a 3.5 million edge to Biden, and that is going to go up to probably 5 million because there's still a lot of votes that have not been counted in states that have already been called. California example where Biden will continue to run up those totals. But I still think, especially given the market positivity apparently in the futures, and we're up another 2% plus overnight in the NASDAQ. I mean, Trump is going down fighting tooth and nail for this. And he has this immediate connection with his followers, with his, so-called MAGA army, some might call it. And I just think it's an ugly cocktail out there. So I really think I want to see this in place, this concession, and I don't see it in the immediate future. I think the Republicans in the Senate and elsewhere are sort of victim to that strength of that Trump. Some would call it a cult of personality. Others would call it whatever they want to, but it's clear that his persons have become so dominant in the party. They can see that the votes aren't there for them to win. And if Trump would conveniently leave the scene, they can get on to whatever the future without Trump brings. So I think there will be some voices within the Republican Party, which doesn't really exist. It is Trump's party, but nonetheless, there's nominally still is a Republican Party. We'll try to hedge their bets and not join Trump's call for essentially all the efforts he's making to deny these vote countings, etc. So it's a very tense situation, and we really needed to see it, the final outcome. I think the Senate final outcome is very definitely going into Republican hands, but it's not 100% in place, so we can't call that 100% definitively just yet. But swinging back into the day-to-day action here, and especially what was going on yesterday, Peter, you're pulling out this incredible, and with the move we saw higher across the board in equities, that we have this whole momentum value thing cooking in a very big way, as well as you point out on slide 10.
We had Cliff Asness, the one of the co-founders and current CEO of AQR, and one of the, the big proponents of the value factor, and have done maybe the most research in the entire world on this equity factor. And he was out saying on Twitter yesterday that this was clearly probably the best that could have happened, apparently, for momentum versus value, and that was a Biden victory and a Republican Senate, because then, as we just talked about a few minutes ago, all the right ingredients are still in place for bidding up assets that are in the momentum slash growth basket. And that's basically what you see here. And so the insert on the left side is the ratio between the total return index on US momentum stocks versus value stocks. And as you can see here, it has been an extremely painful trade since 2013. Many famous value investors have closed their shops, basically saying they can't operate in this environment. You have to wonder for how long this could continue, but it does. And yesterday, that's the insert on right. You have Bloomberg's what they call the pure factor portfolio. So this is not long-only portfolios, it's a spread. So you can see here that actually that the momentum was by far the best spread factor yesterday, up almost 5%. So the highest momentum stocks continue to go higher, and the ones with the lowest momentum continue to fall. And that spread between those was 5%. And then on the other hand, you had the pure value portfolio, which was down 5% on a neutral basis. So the most overvalued stocks tend to be also the ones with the highest momentum right now. They gained a lot, more than 5% relative to the other basket, which are the cheap stocks that are not really moving. So it's just another sign of this current market regime we're in, and the TINA and the low interest rates, etc.
And I guess it would likely continue, I suppose, if as long as the general direction of the market is up, or at least until some new macro theme asserts itself. Ola, before we get to the earnings calendar and the macro calendar, you've got some thoughts on food prices.
Yes, indeed, because we just, even though, well, despite, while we had all this volatility across the other markets before and after the election, one area that has not really budged that much is the agricultural space. We're seeing grain prices up strongly again this today, up more than 1%, both soybeans, corn, and wheat. On slide eight, I just inserted the soybean chart weekly going back to 2016, and you can see we're toying with these 4-year highs right now, around this 1100 level, and it is the ongoing concerns about dry weather having an impact, negative impact on production. Right now, that focus is on South America, and that's why we're seeing that price being supported. At the same time, soybean prices domestically in China has reached a record high. Again, indicate some worries about supplies, and that is obviously leading this very, very strong demand for overseas supplies, and that is just an ongoing thing. And that's leading us to the World Food Price Index, which is from an inflation perspective is a bit of a worry, because we've seen that index rise 5 months or 4 months in a row, and undoubtedly, having seen the agricultural index rise 4% last month, we will see another pickup when they release their latest data later today. I'll put out on Twitter once the result is there. But it's just highlighting the worry that inflation may not potentially come from what central banks and governments do, but more from what the weather does. And that's just one we need to keep an eye on.
All right, and Peter, on the earnings season, certainly winding down, but I see some pretty big names there on slide 11 that are coming in today and through Saturday's, as always, oddly timed, Berkshire Hathaway earnings report.
Yeah, Berkshire Hathaway, they want to steal the limelight of the earnings state. So they always do the weekends. But today it's a big day. And just before we talk about today, I just want to highlight that we in our quick take that we do every morning, we highlighted Mercado Libre yesterday as really something to watch. And they certainly delivered 7% higher in its share price, very, very strong quarterly earnings and revenue that beat expectations, and they still see strong demand in South America. It's the equivalent of Amazon down there in that continent. And despite some of the economies reopening, they still see a lot of adoption of online retailing down there. So I think a super interesting company with, I think, at least a decade or two, if we use Amazon as the trajectory for growth going forward. If we look today, we have already had AstraZeneca reporting. That was a so-so earnings release. They sound pretty optimistic on their COVID-19 vaccine with the University of Oxford, so that was okay. They're beginning now to sell their new breast cancer drug that they bought recently. That's okay, but their earnings was a little bit below expectations because their R&D and other costs have gone significantly up during this COVID-19 crisis. And then I just wanted to highlight Nintendo because they have also already reported the shares were up 2% in Japan. Their Switch consoles, they're lifting the fiscal year guidance to 24 million units versus previously 19 million. So they're seeing a huge pickup. I think they have sold 42% more units compared to just, the revenue is up 42% on the Switch console compared to last year. So really impressive numbers coming out of Nintendo. And otherwise, I just want to highlight that people today will be watching Square, Uber, Alibaba, and then Regeneron Pharmaceuticals. Those four are the main focus points today in the earnings season.
All right. And the other focus, of course, being on these counts, final counts coming in from the U.S. election. Stay tuned for that. And then on the central bank front, we have the Bank of England out, oddly moving their meeting result and an announcement to early this morning. So they're already out. The QE increase there was larger than expected, or at the larger end of expectations, plus $150 billion. This is just a non-event. People know it was coming. And, you know, sort of offsets the new fiscal expansion necessary to deal with these new COVID-19 shutdowns, lockdowns in the UK. We have the Norwegian Central Bank up shortly this morning, and the initial jobless and continuing claims, which, should be one of the better high frequency figures out of the US. But unfortunately, there's been a lot of revisiting of that because of some of the skew in the data based on the crush of applications. And charges of fraud and things like that are causing some inaccuracies in that number. I think that as time goes by, it'll become an increasingly good measure of the state of the U.S. jobs market. That ADP number yesterday out at a very disappointing plus 365K, that was the worst in 4 months, and is a sign of concern, as is, again, the outlook for reduction of stimulus. Republican leader Mitch McConnell is out saying he's happy to increase the stimulus a little bit here before the end of the year. But still, they're dead set against this, funds for local and state governments, et cetera, that the Democrats want. So it'll be modest stuff. And of course, the blocking of massive stimulus next year is a certain risk to the real economy, U.S. economy next year. ISM services was also slightly disappointing. We have an FOMC meeting tonight. Look at the markets blasting vertical to the upside. No problem with financial conditions. I think they'll moan a lot about fiscal, needing more fiscal to support the economy, but I don't think there's anything forthcoming from them tonight that's of interest besides maybe long-term policy hints of this and that, which they've already done anyway with their average inflation targeting regime. So really not expecting the Fed is moving the needle here in tonight's meeting. With that, we'll look at, of course, the rest of the week. Friday, what brings the non-farm payrolls change and unemployment rate, et cetera. So we'll be looking for that as well. And for today, let's call it a day. And we'll be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call. Thanks for joining.